You're listening to Worldbuilding for Masochists.
And we're wondering why we do this to ourselves.
Because sometimes you learn something hilariously bizarre about medieval heraldry, and then you just have to do something with that information. I'm Cass Morris.
I'm Marshall Ryan Maresca.
I'm Natanya Barron. And this is episode 127, Expanding Worlds.
We can occasionally behave ourselves when we really put effort into it.
When we have to.
Hey, speaking of putting effort into things, we have a big announcement. It'll be several weeks old by the time this episode comes out, but we haven't had a chance to talk about it yet.
And what's that, Cass?
Please do tell.
This is brand new information. Brand new information. Is there everyone here? No, it's not. We are Hugo finalists for a fourth year in
Ding, 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 ding. Wow. Well, it's my first time. It's my first time.
Yes, it is. It's Natanya's first time.
It's my first time ever. So, yeah.
That's so exciting.
That's a lot. I was not expecting. I mean, we knew ahead of time a little bit because they kind of give you some time for preparations and stuff. I wasn't quite prepared for the onslaught of just like their discords that I have not been part of for a very long time, that my entire thing was lighting up with congratulations and whatnot. So, whereas most people in the world don't have any idea what the Hugos are.
Yeah.
Our audience does, and our friends do, which is pretty lovely.
It's really nice to get Google alerts for your name that are that and not, hey, your book is up on another pirate site, which is what most of my Google alerts are.
Yeah.
But yes, we are very excited and very happy, and we are so, so, so grateful to everyone who nominated us. Thank you so much. Truly, it means so much to us that you're continuing to nominate us every year. I think 2023 was a banger year, personally.
We did some good shows over the course of the year. I think we get better every year because we're constantly growing and learning. So therefore, we're getting better every year.
And we have some very cool stuff coming up this year. Not to name drop, but I did name drop a thing that's happening to a friend of mine tonight, and she would like almost fell out of her chair. So there's going to be some cool stuff happening this year too. So we'll continue to beat our drum of world building masochism.
Yes. So now that we're finalists again, hey, vote for us.
Yeah.
If you're a voting type person, vote for us. We are going to try. It's not confirmed yet that all of us will be, but we are trying to all be in Scotland for Worldcon, including Rowena. Rowena is also going to try. I really hope we can all be there. I hope we can all four be there, and it'll be awesome.
Be very, very.
That
cool.
Will be awesome. I'm working. I was today working on logistics, and hopefully that'll all work out. But we'll see.
I have to renew my passport. Oh. I remembered that today.
Yeah, get on that because that takes a bit.
It does. It does.
Yeah,
they're saying 6 to 8 weeks right now, but I don't know if I believe them.
Well, we're excited. Well, we were planning to go to Scotland because it's our 20th anniversary, my husband and I. So. We just moved. We were going to go in October, so we're just like, we hadn't made any plans yet officially, and we're like, nope, let's just do it in August. So yeah, we're gonna do London for a couple of days and then do Scotland, which is what we did when we were that was our honeymoon. So we're gonna go back now without being impoverished 20-year-olds or 23-year-olds as we were when we got married.
Europe is more fun when you have at least like some discretionary income. Yeah.
Turns out staying in hostels in the middle of London, not super great if you want to actually sleep. Being horizontal, that'll happen. But other than that, no. We had a car alarm. We thought it was super cool because it was like in the Notting Hill neighborhood. But Notting Hill is pretty large and parts of it are just really busy. And there was a car alarm literally going off all night long. The entire night.
Isn't that part of being 23 where sleep is semi-optional? I mean,
yeah,
that's my memory of that, which because it was a while ago.
Oh, God. Yeah, I vividly recall my first trip to the UK was a college trip. So I was 20. I really didn't need sleep, which was good. Because a lot of nights we were still out when the sun was coming up. That was usually our cue to be like, oh, we should probably leave the pub and go to bed because we've got class in 3 hours.
Oops.
Wild.
Hey, I got A's in both those classes. So it was fine. but I am not 20 anymore.
you begin to learn that your body doesn't respond quite the same way it used to back in the day, especially to lack of sleep.
Yeah, and I think the weird thing now, though, too, is, like, I can't just sleep in to make it better. Like, I used to be able to just, I could sleep in all day. But once 8 o'clock rolls around, it doesn't work anymore. And then I have to pee. And then once I have to pee, it's done, right? Like your whole body is ready to go. So, like, I went from, you know, I could.
Sorry, no, you got vertical.
Yeah. We're done.
We're up
so,
now.
So, yeah, I'm trying to lean into this whole thing of being an early riser, which is just not, was not part of my original stat set. so
no,
but speaking of being exhausted, I do have a book coming out shortly, so we thought we would just mention that really quickly. What's been exciting this week is my physical arcs for Queen of None have, like, hit a bunch of people.
I know, so, I've seen them popping up on Instagram,
so I keep getting tagged in posts and stuff, which is both incredibly, even though this book has already been through the circuit, it's going to a much bigger audience now. But it's so cool to see the, like, little setups, that, especially bookstagrammers are just so aesthetic, right? There's just so much care that's being done. So, like, candles being lit and, like, flower petals next to my book. And it's really lovely. So I'm very excited about that. So that's May 24th. So I'm not sure exactly when this is airing, but it's going to be not too far off from then.
It'll be a few more weeks. Yeah.
So pre-orders are still open everywhere. Books are available. Solaris uses Simon & Schuster for distribution, so it will be in all the places. So, very excited. I commissioned some custom art for it as well, which is going along beautifully. This is my attempt to beat AI by simply just paying artists to make beautiful things.
You got to do what... Something.
I gotta do something because I'm just so incensed. But I have both of my book series. I've got artists who are working on just some beautiful artwork for that. So I'll be sharing that in a couple of weeks as well. And then, the sequel to that comes out in December. And then the first of the Netherford Hall books, the Love in Netherford series books comes out in August. So you'll have a lot of me to be sick about then. But yeah, and the Love in Netherford is very romantic-y, like, and I've done a lot of reading on what that definition is after our conversation with Gwen DeBond. And yes, the romance is essential to the plot of those books. The second book in the Queen of Fate series is romantic-y, but the first and third ones are not. The first is romantic fantasy, and the third one is just fantasy. There's not really romance in it. There's a little bit, but it's like cutesy romance. So yeah, I'm going to be really busy. I'm not really sure how to promote 6 books in 2 years without being incredibly obnoxious.
I think you just got to lean into that.
You got to roll with it. Yeah,
you just got to take it.
Yeah,
just own it.
I'm trying to just.
I think more authors should just accept be incredibly obnoxious. Except the ones that are so obnoxious, they need to take it down a notch. But no cool people, including Unitani, are ever that.
Well, I'm mostly excited for the audiobook, which I think I've talked about before, but I got the whole, like, pronunciation guide, which is beautiful that the voice actor actually asked questions about pronunciation and wanted to know, like, particularly how I wanted names to be envisioned. And of course, as a non-Brit writing Brit lit, it was kind of interesting, but I think we've got it. At least the way I want things pronounced. Cause I have read some people's pronunciation of Sir Gawain before in ways that literally make my teeth feel like they're going to fall out of my head with anxiety. Cause I just, it's not how we say that name. but whatever.
That's such a fun process.
You don't
That's
like it when
process,
people say
though.
Gawain.
The worst is Gawain.
Wow.
Gawain. And
that's a choice. Yeah. That's a whole choice.
Yeah. And it's okay. I mean, I feel for audio narrators. I have done it in my past. I love doing it. I would love to retire doing audiobook narration. Retire, right? but it's got to be. It's incredibly hard to balance all of that. And I have some very bizarre names in there, and I can't take credit for that. So, but yeah. So that's.
I had so much fun doing that with my audiobook narrator too, because you know mine was Latin stuff, and I got to be like, okay. So Latin would pronounce it this way, but I think that sounds stupid. So in my head, it's this. The V's are not W's. They're just not.
Venus.
I
that just sounds
them to
silly.
Be W's, I
it just sounds silly
W's.
To an English speaking ear. And it's like, I know that's probably, although we're not 100%. There might be a class distinction too in that. It's been theorized. And then I'm wildly inconsistent when it comes to like the C's and G's that should be hard. And I'm like, sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. I don't know. This is how it is in my head. And I told my narrator, it's like, honestly, if it's easier for you, if it fits the flow easier for you to say it a different way, I'm not bothered.
Mm-hmm.
It's a dead language.
Yep.
It can't get mad at you or me.
This is true.
Just do what makes sense. Because I really liked the first time I read Jacqueline Carey's Cuccio's Legacy mm-hmm. series, I remember seeing a note on her blog about pronunciation. And she was like, well, here, you know, I sort of go with mostly it's French and here's how I pronounce it. But really, it's your book now. So pronounce it how it makes sense in your head. And I'm like, that's a good attitude. That is a good way.
Yeah.
That's like,
yeah. But while we have some amount of control as authors, yes, right? Because I think yes, so much feels out of our control. I was just lucky that we have such a phenomenal narrator. And like when I heard her, it was just like full body chills. It was like, okay, she completely gets this. This is the voice that I was looking for. But that doesn't always happen.
Okay.
I mean, I listen to a lot of audiobooks and I listened to one recently and you could actually hear one of the narrator's sessions change. And this is like a published Audible book, very popular book, but there was
it's not from 1995 where the CD changes over.
No, it was just a lot of inconsistency in the individual recorder's sessions, and you could hear I don't think everyone hears that, but for those of us who listen to a lot of audio, we hear that.
Or just have ears tuned to that sort of thing where you're like, ooh, something just changed.
Yes. Yeah.
You're in a different booth now.
You're in a different booth, or you had a cold last time, or maybe you have like, I don't know, there's a lot of other options.
You did not drink your pineapple juice before this one.
Or there might have been rereads too. I mean, you don't know. And it is really hard not to talk about Baldur's Gate 3 again, because it's my favorite topic these days. But in the first release that came out, there were some really, really obvious second sessions. And in subsequent patches, they fixed some of it. But if a company that big making a game that's making $90 million in its first weekend or first few weekends of release can't get it right, it just shows you how hard consistent audio is. There's just many potential things. So,
I mean, half the time when I'm watching TV, I'm like, that line was ADR.
Oh, the ADR is the worst,
yep,
though.
They fixed that in post, didn't they? Yep.
The worst is when you find out, like, a current movie. Like, ADR was so common, like, years ago, right? That was half of the movie, if not all of it, was ADR. Now, though, it's so glaring. Although, every once in a while, I'll watch a movie, and you can tell one entire actor was ADR'd, like, the entire time, and nobody else's. And there's just no way for us to fix it. You just can't replicate a sound room afterwards. I don't know. It's just bizarre.
Though, which I think I read somewhere that Farscape, almost all of the dialogue is ADR, but that's because like their set, for some reason, their set was just like you needed to have the air conditioners blowing constantly. And so it was just like, nope, just we're just not going to get good sound on set. But then with everything being ADR, you then at least have a consistent tone throughout, whereas you can totally hear when something is just like dropped in. I love it when it's something I'm watching and I hear it dropped in and I'm like, somebody thought we need one more line to explain something because this is not going to be.
And the test audience did not make the connection between these two scenes. So,
so let's just throw in another line.
Yeah. His head's turned.
It's
here.
Always like we when can, the character,
yeah, it's like,
exactly. The character like conveniently turns around.
But we also have, speaking of expanding worlds, we have the anthology coming up, which
we
almost
do.
Has a cover. we're getting there, but super exciting. So what are some cool updates we can give people on that, friends?
At the point where we're recording, we have like 99% finished the editing and it'll be going to a copy editor next. And I am just so jazzed about these stories. They're so much fun.
They are so fun.
They're so fun. So I love how many of our contributors like took each other's gifts that were given to us like 3 years ago. And they're like, I'm going to take this and put it in my story. It was not my gift. I'm taking somebody else's. It's like, yay. That's exactly what we hoped everyone would do, is piece through all the little bits and stitch them together and make sense out of this thoroughly chaotic world that we're creating. It's delightful. I cannot wait for people to read these.
Samesies.
They're just really fun, really cool stories. We have stories, of course, from the three of us and from Rowena. We have stories from Mike Chen, Victor Menebo, Valerie Valdez, Marie Brennan, Kate Elliott. I'm doing this for, I should be
looking
at
this. You're doing it from memory, I know.
I'm doing it from memory. Kate Elliott, and then two
if you forget
stories,
anyone, you can add it in post. You can.
That's true.
We'll drop it in ADR.
Indeed, we could do that. We've got a nonfiction piece by Mike Underwood, and we've got new stories by first-time published authors Lindsay Carmichael and J.C. Pillard.
So cool.
I got it all. You can tell I've been looking at these lists.
Yes, you have. You have.
Very cool.
So yes, that's super exciting. And it allows us to bounce nicely into the topic for today, you know, 17 minutes into the episode. That's
which
pretty
is
good for us, actually.
Ahead of time for us of late.
Which is we're gonna do a little magical Newt Gate world building, which we've done a few times before in the past, where we sort of take topics from recent episodes and apply them to our world, and specifically sort of the cultures that we have each taken control and responsibility for. So we're gonna at least start there. But we've also had, like, a lot of our episodes lately have not been like topics. They've been different kind of topic. Broader things the last several months. I was going back through the list and I was like, oh, we don't actually have that many like discrete, like religion, government, whatever, that kind of topics. So we might pull in a few other like world building staples, like mm-hmm. good things to think about in your world building as well.
Though, before we jump to that, I want to put Natanya on the spot about her section of the world.
Okay.
And more specifically, what their relationship with the magical Newt Gates are.
Oh, yes. So I did think about this in Mirrodin. Let me think back. So I touched on it a little bit in my story, which is exciting. Lumi and the Navigator. I love the concept of navigators. I just thought that was the badassiest thing ever.
Many of our writers.
Yeah, they're just, I think we all love a little like, I don't know, a little subclass of people or whatever. It just felt really cool. I think there's sort of, I liked the idea of when we talk, I think we talked a couple of times ago, and feel free to correct me if I'm wrong because my brain is not firing at all.
You're allowed to retcon your
syllables
own stuff
here.
Too.
Syllables, see? Silters. Oh, Lord. But I like the idea that if you go back far enough with the Gates, that there's some sort of like quasi either religious or sort of supernatural rituals around them, right? That they mean something culturally to these people, because this is a very, very far off place. So, and it's a very hazardous environment a lot of the year. So it's hard to get anywhere comfortably. You kind of have to, kind of survival. But to me, especially with like the idea of like resonance and music that I've been thinking a lot about with this area, maybe there's something, whether it's true or not, sort of in the sort of ritual and worship of sort of deity that's connected to not just Gates themselves, but the sort of the larger concept of connectivity, right? Because I think that's what's so cool about that, right? And I was thinking about when I took an Eastern religions course in college, my professor was talking about the jeweled net that connects everybody, and sort of like that everyone is sort of a jewel on this great net of around the world. And we all kind of are these magical little moments in time of, you know, the universe expressing itself as a human, right? That's kind of the most, you know, sort of agnostic way of looking at it for to all religions, right? That human beings tend to be an expression of some kind of deity something. But what would Gates be? And I kind of like the idea of, because I'm a biology nerd myself, that there are like the Gates in the areas have different plants and rocks associated with them. So like they kind of like color coded, or I don't know, botanically coded, but there might one be that's like emeralds and moss, right? And they've kind of, you walk toward it and it's almost like you're going through an altar that has sort of this meaning, and perhaps it's connected to local gods, or it's connected to some kind of local belief, but that each of the individual gates in this particular realm, however many we've decided that there are, has sort of this, it smells different, it looks different, it feels different, and it has its own kind of commitment from biology around it, and perhaps geology as well. Does that sound reasonable?
It does.
And perhaps even their own songs dedicated to those gates. So, and maybe things that happened around them, whether they be battles or, you know, epic stories or things of that nature.
I think it is a very natural thing for there to be a lot of cultures that have a lot of spirituality about the gates. I mean, I think that's just common sense. If you have this thing that right, people are going to have opinions about it, and those opinions are probably going to veer towards the spiritual.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps even people came through that happened to save them from something, or people came through that created a war, right? There's all kinds of things that could have happened. I think although we have a pretty peaceful exchange, things like diseases can come through, right? You know, and it could have been like way back in their history, and it's part of the mythology. But I kind of like that there are these sort of apocryphal stories and how different cultures kind of approach them. Like, do you need to do things to appease the gate so that good people come through? You know, do you have to do things that, like, do you wish something bad on someone? Do you hope that something is going to come in and change their lives a little bit? So, yeah. But I like the idea of sort of like florally festooned gates, you know, myself.
I think that's really cool.
Good. Yes. So, what topic do we want to start with and make up answers for our cultures? I wrote them down, so someone else has to pick the first one.
Oh, so, well, we can go in reverse order of episodes we did, including talking about, you know, weird biology, leaning towards bug biology, but I don't think we need to limit ourselves to the insect world, but weird, neat things with creatures and biology that can be in our culture. I know, so in Griasto, we've already established some of them, because we have the hallucinogenic slugs.
We have the famous snails, yes.
We have the famous snails. And also, they've got the giant sloths there, which we haven't talked about in a long time.
We haven't done anything with those, yeah.
I mean, but they've got giant sloths, and they use them. I mean, I don't think we've specifically talked about the giant sloths, like, domesticated or tamed, like, I kind of like the idea that the giant sloths have the same sort of cultural sense that maybe like cows do in Hinduism, like that they're holy, and like they'll just walk through the town and people are just like, you let the sloths walk through the town. Don't get in their way. Don't mess with them. They're doing their thing. You do your thing.
They'll move when they're good and ready.
They'll move when they're good and ready. Exactly.
They move in their own time. I mean, that feels like it has spiritual connotation to it as well.
Kind of reminds me of the mystics in the Dark Crystal, who I always loved because they were so slow and thoughtful and lumbering, but they were also magical. So, well, I invented the Eskin in Mirrodin, and they are based on civets, but sort of larger, well, yeah, around the same size of a civet, but a little bit closer to, like, personality wise of like the sort of like, what are they called, mongooses and things like that. So they're a little bit more lithe, and they have a very connected relationship with the folks that are there who collect the spider silk. So they help them kind of.
I was going to say, you have the tree spiders.
I have the tree spiders. So. but they kind of have a sort of symbiotic relationship where they all kind of work together. And they're kind of like almost familiar levels. So I actually, in my story, it's a dual narrative. And one is literally the myth of the Eskin and how they come to be. And then one lives in the present when the main characters are kind of experiencing. And they do go through the gates, and they're sort of like gate sniffers, so they can sense magic as well as they can sense sort of this but they can climb, they're, you know, they also smell faintly of popcorn because civets do, and fun nerd fact, but that is something that is used in perfumery. So civet musk and civet smell is one of those things as well. So that kind of class of animal I always found very, very fascinating, sort of between a cat and a dog, and not quite any of them, but also has sort of like lemurish capabilities too, with really long, cool tails and things of that nature. And then I love the idea of more bugs. I think more bugs is like my note for everything moving forward right now in my life, because I think I did a really bad job of bugs in the last book that I wrote. So I want more bugs. But I love the idea of, again, sort of like musicality being used to repel bugs, because, you know, bugs are a problem, especially in sort of the super Nordic climates where they're only out for a small period of time, but it happens to be the nice time of year. So it's like you want to enjoy yourself, but all you're doing is getting caught in swarms. So I thought it would be cool if there were sort of resonances that these people have come up with on their musical instruments, and they could literally kind of keep them away from their villages by having someone sort of patrol and play like maybe like a bagpipe kind of instrument that literally repels the clouds of mosquitoes from coming in.
It's like beating the bounds, yes. but with music rather than, yes. Yeah.
And then I think there needs to be messenger beetles. And I don't know if that's in my world or somewhere else, but I love the idea of big ass beetles that are big enough to attach letters to and can travel long distances and know, because they do. They move from area to area, pheromones and all that kind of stuff. But if magic is involved, why not convince them to go somewhere else? Instead of messenger pigeons, we have beautiful iridescent winged messenger beetles.
There was something I saw which was set in a prison where the prisoners had messenger roaches.
I like that.
Like they put little messages on the roaches and tape them, then the messages mm-hmm. would get delivered where they need to go. How did the roaches know where to go? You don't need to know that.
Suspension of disbelief.
As long as the roaches know, then.
Yeah, the roaches know, and they get the job done, and you get your messages throughout the prison as you need them.
Yep.
Well, in Fjallanir, we know we have the domesticated otters, which multiple authors picked up on in the anthology, because everyone just wants an adorable little pet otter, and I get it, because the paws, they're precious. Listeners, you can't see, but I'm doing the paws with my hands.
It is adorable.
And it's precious. It is precious.
So we have those. We have the serviced wyverns as well, who must be... They must have a unique adaptation, evolutionary-wise, because wyvern creatures, you would not think cold climate, necessarily. Like, they can't be truly reptilian in that mm-hmm. way. They have some other, like, evolutionary tree that helps them stay warm. And I was thinking about adding something new, and I think I'm giving Fjallanir chameleon fish, color-changing fish. Because, like, the big old river, right, that goes up... And I was thinking, like, as this river goes through different strata, it's going to have lots of different kinds of, like, rocks and soil beneath it. And what if some of those are, like, really brightly colored in some areas? Like, in some areas, it's, like, really bright, like, jade green rocks. And if you're a white fish, you're going to stand out against those green rocks, and you're going to get it. And then what if it's like, silver rocks, and then it's, like, iridescent rocks further up? And so I think they've evolved some chameleon fish, some color-changing fish that can change color as they go swimming up and downstream. Through these various different rock strata. And I thought that was fun. And I also think it sort of plays into, like we were talking about with, like beetle wing, decorations, beading and stuff like that. I think the scales could work in a similar way too. Like they could be an interesting fashion item in some way. And then I started thinking about other things, and I was like, so we got to have some cool bears too. Cause if you got fish swimming upstream, you need some cool bears. I don't know what the bears look like.
Well,
yet.
Do the bears out, maybe, but... do their colors change like flamingos if they eat the different fish at different times?
Oh, that should. They should. Oh. Yes. So we got some like jade green bears in this one particular region.
I love that. I love
that's
that.
That's funny.
I know they're not, bears are not friends. They're wild animals, but they're so cute.
If not friend, why so huggable looking?
Especially when they're babies. Oh, I saw a video of a guy who lives like out in the hinterlands in Appalachia somewhere, and they found an abandoned baby bear cub, and they were waiting for the, you know, the animal control to come take him, and it had fallen asleep on his chest, and I was like almost in tears. Oh. Just, and it was, and its dog was like also taking care of it at the same time. So
bless.
Yeah,
I mean, there's the video, it's like with 4-year-old girl is on the back of her porch and she's just going, can I pet that dog? Can I pet that dog? And no, it's a bear.
No, honey, no.
That's a full bear that will eat you. But
or at least, yeah. Most of them just want your food. Or at least
maul you.
But yeah, if especially, yeah. But you can see why people thought that they were like yetis and things and gods walking the woods, especially skinny bears have such a human gait to them and they can stand up and some of them lose their fur. Have you ever seen those videos of the bears that get alopecia? It will haunt your nightmares. Like you don't,
I can imagine
they need their fur. You know. They need their fur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Most fur creatures look stranger without it.
We must look so weird to them.
We must look very strange to them. I always wonder like what they think of us.
Why this and not, yeah.
But I don't know, my puppy thinks my hair is there to be a chew toy, so.
Maybe that's why, like, dogs are so, you know, concerned about us. Because, like, look at you. You have nothing to protect yourself. We need to do something about this.
Oh, man. Well, I think that's a good little group of characters, of animalian friends. I always think, of course, about, like, the environmental ramifications of those things too. Like if the bears eat the fish that are that color, are the fish eating something that helps them stay that color? You know, how is it
like something in their plankton or something that they're eating that helps with the chameleon effects? I'm going to be honest with you. I don't actually know how chameleons work.
It's very fascinating and it's very different. Camouflage in nature happens like, so octopuses, they do camouflage to match, right? Mm-hmm. Chameleons, they found out, don't actually do it to match. They do it to express feeling. It's literally how fun. They feel is the different colors. So if they're threatened, if they're comfortable, and if you look at the microscopic way that the colors do, it's like nothing else in the natural world.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I want eyeshadow that does that.
I know, right? Like,
eyeshadow that just flares if I get pissed. Like, uh-oh.
Yep. They're really fascinating creatures. And of course,
why aren't the tech bros working on that instead of
because it's a lot harder to convince people to part with their money when you're talking about stuff like that. Because that's all it is. It's just,
I don't know, I think they're talking to the wrong people.
Possibly. But color changing is so interesting in nature. And it was actually one of the best April Fool's jokes that I saw was one of the, I think it was a Florida, it might have been the Tampa Aquarium or the Tampa Zoo, but they said they had a blue penguin or blue flamingo and they photoshopped it, but it was really cute. It was like, you know, we don't know why, but you know, well, it was adorable. That and the Barnes and Nobles. That was really funny.
That one was funny.
As someone who worked at a Barnes and Noble and also thought that, hey, if I could get one book here, I would be set for life, right? That's how it works. All these people, they have so much money because they publish books.
The naivete of our youth.
So adorable. So,
so precious.
We were so young. We were so dumb. Oh.
So speaking of things to be terrified.
I was going to say, speaking of
monsters. What are the monsters of our societies? And as per our discussion with John, what does that tell us about what our societies fear?
And are they real or are they just the cultural myths?
It's a good question in fantasy worlds, right? Because it's always like, where is the line? You know, we have some clearly like fantastical creatures like the wyverns, but that doesn't mean necessarily that all fantastical creatures are real. And I think the Fialinari definitely have some that are not real, but that they are scared of, that's in their media and things like that. And I think they're like chaos demons. I think the Fialinari are deeply upset
by things that introduce. I'm going to spill ink on your paperwork.
Yes, like anything like that. I was actually also thinking about like, I bet they have some kind of shapeshifter, but it's not like a werewolf. They might have werewolves too, or werebears or something. But those are fine because they're predictable. You know when that's going to change because it's the full moon. That's fine. But I think shapeshifters that like either like they choose when to change and you can't predict it, or they can't predict when they're going to change. It's like an uncontrollable change. I think those would be very scary monsters to the Fialinari. Things you can't predict are scary to my very buttoned up people. Very orderly.
I also like the idea of the monsters in one culture just being misheard versions of creatures in other lands. and this comes from being a medievalist and looking at beautiful illustrations of things like elephants, where you're like, you heard third person what an elephant might look like, and then drew that.
And then
that.
You tried to draw it.
And
it's great.
And I love that. I love that. So I would love the idea, since we have established that Mirrodin and Fjallnir have had back and forth, that they think the wyverns are huge, and they think that they are absolutely like blood sucking, like come at almost like vampiric at night, come and take you.
Because like some traveler talked about, like, oh yeah, I woke up and the wyvern was just cuddled right into my neck, and they're like, it was what?
It was exactly. So that's kind of, so it would be great. A story of someone actually meeting one. And then the other one, I want gold to be important. I've always loved sort of the gold hoarding cultures, that, you know, maybe there's some good veins of a good old gold up there somewhere. But this idea that there are some kind of creature or monster that destroys gold, that it is sort of like this fear of this precious thing being, you know, not just hoarded, but actually destroyed. And that's sort of this fear of, like, when you live in an environment that's as unpredictable and unforgiving, waking up and finding those things that you have kept to yourself, these beautiful brooches that you've created and you know, all of this beautiful jewelry, to have been corrupted and like fall apart in your hand. And there's something very, very scary about that. So whether it's like rats or bugs or something that does it, I think in D&D, there's something that maybe it's bugs, or they're the bugs that look like coins. But maybe it is. Maybe it's just bugs that, maybe it's real. Maybe there's some examples where they excrete some kind of horrific enzyme.
Some kind of like mite that like dissolves it or changes its chemical compound.
Yeah.
And
by the,
that would make sense.
By the time you find it, your entire bag of coin is gone. Right.
Well, you can totally get that too, because like that could be a real thing that gets magnified in the way of many monsters. Like, this is a real thing. It does happen. And from that, we get the story of the gold-eating monsters who will creep into your house.
With the Griastans, I definitely feel I need to lean into body horror of some sort with what their monsters are.
Well, they're
are.
So laid back that, like, what they fear must reflect that as well in a strange way, so.
So, the thing I was thinking about, and I think this to them is more like legend than like actual thing, that, but maybe it's real. So who knows? But that you'll see somebody who you find alluring and attractive, and when you approach them, they don't have a body.
Ooh.
And then they push you out of yours and take it from you. And now you are without a body at all.
So you have to do that to the next person? Is that the idea? Or are you just
Or you're just stuck. Because you're not one of these creatures. You can only get your own body back. But how are you going to get your own body back unless they're evicted? So I think that's a thing. That's definitely their legend. Mm-hmm. Is it real? I don't know.
I can see there being stories and myths around that.
That is suitably scary.
Like the story of some hero who gets pushed out of their body and has to like somehow convince a wizard to push the, you know, like the though they're incorporeal, they have to convince a wizard to push the thing back out of their body so they can get their body back. Like that could be a story.
It sounds very thinnish to me. Like that kind of horror sounds very like,
I was thinking like, it sounds like the Vila and the Rusalka almost,
totally.
But then it becomes not a physical destruction of you, but a,
Cause I think for them, like so much of them are, you know, engaging pleasures of the flesh. So the worst possible fate is to just no longer have a body.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Death to hedonism, right?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And when you're in the state, you're cold and feel nothing.
That would be scary for them. I feel like that too. Like you've talked before about the Griastans' views on like death and things like that. And I can see those things sort of like weaving in and out of each other. So, other things to be terrified of. Love and romance.
Yes. Oh, man.
That may be subjective. That may be.
I mean, it varies from person to person, culture to culture, how terrified they are of.
So, yes, what is love and romance like in our cultures? What are some of the gestures, the rituals, the phases of how people...
Expectations. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. What's, yeah. Like...
What are they aiming at? What do they think they're getting into?
Like, do the parents in your culture be like, someday you're going to meet seven nice people and the eight of you will will form a marriage? Like, you know, what's the norm?
I like the idea of the open-ended polycule option, which I think I talked about on my first episode. But it's very much with the, like, you've got to be able to provide for people emotionally, physically, sensually, all of these things. And the divorce clauses are very easy. You know, like if you're not doing it, that's it. Like, you know, you've got to hold up your end of the bargain. Everyone's got to be happy in order for it to all work. Whatever arrangement it is, whether it's truly a full polyamorous polycule, I'm sorry, I'm not necessarily up on all the lingo, but whether it's one, like everyone's involved with everyone or people have separate other people, but it needs to be a lot of communication. I think that part is like really important. And I think in this particular culture, there's really no concern about queerness. That's just sort of an expected, maybe you go through periods of time like that. Maybe that's who you are from the time you were born. Maybe you have this person and that person. But there's also, I think, an affection for people who do sort of create a lasting bond with each other. And there's sort of I called it the heart song, right? That you sort of, you find someone's song. And when you find your heart song person, that's sort of like, not quite a fated mate, but this is your twin flame, right? This is your person that you're meant to be with. And that kind of follows you through your life. I do think in my culture, I've been thinking more about sort of having like a kind of priest caste sort of group of people and then kind of the regulars. And you're not really, it's not like illegal, but it's preferred that you stay within those who have sort of religious visions and sort of, you know, part of the religious culture kind of stay together because it's believed that, like, you know, you can kind of amplify the spiritual aspects if you kind of put together kind of like magic users versus non-magic users kind of things. Though there's a lot of sort of mundane sort of things as well, but it doesn't always not happen. Of course, I think there's probably some great myths and love stories about people who fall madly in love across lines. And that's sort of, you know, very romanticized, just as we do with, you know, princes and paupers and things of that nature and Cinderellas, because we do love that sort of thing. But I do love a ridiculous social structure. So got to have one in there at least.
Because ridiculous social structures are fun.
They are. Well, and their limitations. And I think that's, we talk a lot about that on here, right? It's like rope building is not just about the fun stuff. It's about what makes it harder for someone to exist in that world, whether or not they have proximity to wealth or oracles or religion or whatever can change how we build that character in that world. And I love courtship rituals. I love ridiculous amounts of that. And I don't love dowries, but I love the idea of needing to kind of like bestow something upon people for the next generation, that there are sort of like torques or fabrics or instruments or things that, like, when you're ready to find your twin person or persons, you are bequeathed this thing. And it is your job to kind of carry this down to the next generation.
So in Griesta, I mean, they're very much a pansexual free love society. And so I'm thinking, I mean, just me thinking inversely, that the biggest romantic gesture is declaring you're not going to have sex with each other. And so, like, the big romance stories are of two people who, like, will just pine for each other without actually consummating for, you know, years and years. And then that's considered like, oh, that's, you know, these
real commitment.
That's how much they loved each other. That's
they're all Rogue and Gambit.
Yeah. I knew it would appeal to you, Cass.
And occasionally Gambit and Cyclops. Yeah.
That, like, the act of romance along those lines is doing these, like, is like writing long letters and, like, doing things intentionally to stay apart. I think they celebrate yearning.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I like that, though.
Well, because and sort of, you know, it makes sense, too, because like long distance relationships, I think, would be a thing that would really appeal in that case. And your people are sort of, you know, different islands and different areas of, because Griasta is not just Snailik Island. so, like, I don't know. I can see that being, yeah.
Ooh.
I used good words there. That was great. That
you
was good
did.
Sentencing.
No, but like, that just inspired me the idea of, like, that, like, their greatest, like, romance stories are just these, like, epistolatory relationships of two people who never met. And they only wrote letters to each other.
Aw.
I like it.
I mean, they still have sex with other people.
Right.
Because that's
But it's
fun.
Never quite going to scratch the itch, right?
It's yeah, there's...
And I think the poems, I almost imagine like sort of troubadour-style poetry and song that's like, you know, I kissed his lips, but his lips were not yours. You know, I burned, but not for the right, you know, all of that sort of thing. And those songs become popular and people can like, yeah.
I love it.
I think letter writing is probably also very important to Fjallanir'i courtship rituals, but for very different reasons. It's not even that you send them across distance because they are, paper is so important in their culture. And way back when I was first coming up to Fjallanir'i, I think I talked about like different kinds of paper, different weights of paper, different textures of paper having different meanings.
Mm.
And I bet that plays into courtship rituals in a very serious and intense and like Byzantine sort of way. Like
I could see them having like this whole set of like a codes of like what, you know, what kind of paper and what kind of
means what,
use,
yes,
means
yes,
what, but also like this whole like your intention to court, you have to send a cover letter.
Here's my resume.
I mean, possibly, yeah. I was sort of thinking about like what they would expect. I think they are probably on the whole more monogamously inclined than not, but perfectly queer norm. That doesn't matter. But I think their expectations are not of lifelong romances. I think they have no real expectation that you will necessarily spend your entire life with someone that you partner up with. So more like serial monogamy than like lifetime monogamy, because I've talked with this about their government, but I think they have a very big cultural focus on phases of life, on moving from like one stage to the next. And their government is structured like that. There's three councils, each in sort of an age tier. And you can only serve in one in your entire lifetime. You can't, so like people can't just park out in a Senate seat for 60 years. but I think there's probably that too. Like they don't expect that the person you want to bone when you're 20 and the person you want to actually raise children with and the person you want to run a business with in your, you know, 40s and 50s and the person you want to grow old with, those aren't necessarily all the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think their expectations of like shifting partners as you age probably relate a lot to that, to the social structure, the focus they have on these phases of life, that you're looking for different things when you are a different age. And yeah, I think they probably do a lot with that. And there's probably all kinds of like, yeah, their stories are about what happens when you know you're looking for the next phase of life. And it would make age difference romances very difficult, possibly, in some ways, which would be interesting for stories and stuff. I think they're very into...
I can see them having very formal names for each kind of partnership you can have.
I bet they do, yeah. I'm not going to try to come up with those right now. I'm not making a chart right now.
Yeah, I wasn't going to pressure you.
I think they also put a lot of value on lots of small gestures of showing how you feel. I know at some point in some past episode I talked about, because I just love the idea of the carved busks.
Yeah, yeah.
With the... being a gift that you would give someone, so that it's, you know, it's like a busk that you tuck into your bodice or corset that's close to your heart. So I think small things like that, embroidery, like embroidering cuffs for somebody, embroidering collars for people is probably very, very big. Things that you do, things that you have created, because they're so industry focused, they are so like making things focused, that I think taking the time to make something specifically for a person shows a lot of how you care. Yeah. And that
you devoted some of your productivity to
yes,
me.
To me? All to me? Aw. Like, this must have taken you exactly 18 hours. That's really lovely. Probably look at it and know. Like, and you used this weight paper? I'm bowled over. I just don't even know what to say.
I love that. I can imagine the scented papers might be nice too. Some kind of messaging in like the rose scented versus the lily of the valley scented versus the frankincense or whatever flavor we have.
Well, we know they have magic pigments, so I'm sure that plays into the ink that they use when writing too.
And it might mean something different, like Victorian flowers, right? So
I think that's it. Like, I think they have their language.
He wrote me in purple.
But then he signed his name in blue. What does it mean?
My goodness.
I'm just picturing
Fjolinary. They would know what they mean.
They would, but I think Fjolinary teenagers would do the thing.
Would
like we do parsing text things. Messages. Well, that's true. They would keep shifting it too. Like they'd be using it ironically. It'd be like, does he really mean this, or was he just doing it? Like, what's going on? The youth culture is probably wild.
I just had this wild idea of part of the youth culture when you're just looking for somebody to hook up with is something equivalent to Tinder, where everyone puts letters of their, like, you know, how I would be as a lover.
Oh, into gosh. Like, there's like a public board or something. Yeah.
Yes. And
and you pick the one that you want, and then someone reveals themselves. Yeah. And then you swipe right.
And then you write a letter back.
Back. And
deeply improper to take up a lover before you've had at least four correspondences.
Well, if their penmanship is lacking, I mean, what does that say about them?
The attention to detail. I mean, that's important. That's important.
No, I think my people are much sloppier about that sort of thing. And it's more of like, I imagine because Mirrodin is so far away, it's much more sort of like tribal. Like it does not have anywhere. It's a very mercantile culture where it's like sort of, late Danish kind of Danes versus not Vikings, because they weren't exactly Vikings, but so there's a lot of trade going on, but the culture in itself is very based around the villages and sort of who you know. So there is some, I think there's definitely some element of arrangement, but it's more of like really heavy hinting, you know, and it's sort of your duty to involve your parents or parental blob.
A strong culture of passive aggression.
Yeah, but like, you know, well, you know, I think because there it's not as populated, and it's important to make those strategic marriages, right? Especially in the upper priestly class, or however I decide to go that route. I would say actually in that case it is mostly arranged, and different houses have sort of different elements of the spiritual religion. And so you kind of know that you can sow your wild oats to a certain point, but even the heart song is not going to be enough to, it might be enough if they can prove that it's true. But generally speaking, you have alliances that are different for marriage purposes that might be for love purposes. Because wealth is important, and portable wealth is very, very important to these folks. And I imagine we have a series of like emblazoned pins and symbols and things that sort of identify everyone, like cool earrings. I've always liked the idea of like earrings and piercings being sort of culturally relevant. So you kind of know who's who and what's what by that sort of stuff. So maybe you give an earring to someone that you really like. I don't know.
I just had the idea of with both the Greyastans using long distance letters and the Fjallanaries using letters all the time, that there would be this great cultural confusion of like, why are they keep sending me these hot letters and they don't just show up?
Yeah.
like I've made it clear that it's,
that'd be so star-crossed
that they should show that they should come over here, but
he has written me 7 times. He should have moved to the next stage by now. I don't understand. I don't understand.
I was
understand.
Pregnant by 7 letters. Well, I think that we touch a little bit on education, because education and marriage and love are connected. And do teen years even exist in some cultures? Because they certainly don't in some.
Yeah.
I think it depends on the level. I would say in my area, teenagerdom is not really seen necessarily as you need to either work for the temples or you need to work in the trees and weaving and all of that stuff. And once you're old enough to do those things and then prove yourself, you know, adult in those aspects. But there's not sort of this protected period of time between childhood and adulthood. But education is very important, but it's a lot of oral tradition. Not a lot of big books and scrolls and things. It's more learning craft and learning history more than anything. I imagine, they learn everything, right?
They do. I think they have, there's probably, I don't know if they'd exactly call it like teenage, but I think like, once again, the phases of life thing, right? I think like the first 10 years, you're supposed to be learning. That's all you're really supposed to be doing. You're just learning how to function as a human being. 10 to 20, you're still doing some of that, but you are now also learning to work. You are learning what it is you're going to be doing. And so I think those are years where it's okay to sort of like find out what it is that you want to do. But then by the end of those years, you are expected to be more focused and you're taking the courses. Like there's Fjallnir education is very like
comprehensive.
Yes, exactly. There's all kinds of courses to get you into, you know, to prepare you for the life you're going to lead, how you are going to be useful to our society. Are you studying languages? Are you studying maths? Are you studying sciences? They have at least, I think, two or three named universities just in the stories in the anthology, which were not all me. So like they have a lot of that. And then I think they also see education as something ongoing, though, that you never stop learning things. I think investigation in betterment in some way or another is very big throughout life there, that you are expected to like keep advancing in what it is you know and know how to do. And if you can figure out a way to do something more efficiently than anyone's done it before, then that's what makes you famous. Like the guy who improves the printing press so that it works more efficiently, it's like, yes, this man gets a parade. So yeah, I think they learn lots of things, and they spend a lot of time doing so. they probably don't have as many free hours in the day as some other cultures would, especially because they're so far north. They don't have that many hours in the day, literally, as other cultures.
I imagine that there could even be like certain people that are accepted to be just lifelong learners. Like you are a professional student forever. Your job is to go from one thing to another and be.
Well, that's how you cross-reference too. That's how you make sure things are good across like all the different disciplines, is you got to have somebody whose eyes are on everything. Mm-hmm. The deans of knowing or something.
I do like the idea of like, especially parts of Southern Mirrodin and other areas of having like exchange programs though with places outside and like being expected to come back though and sort of marry the sort of super cosmopolitan cultures to improve the products and craft of the people.
Oh, the village life? Yeah.
And maybe go vice versa, right?
I know for the Grayassens it's very casual, but I had this idea that on some level they've got two different like coming of age time rituals. Like one around 13 and then one around 17. And that period between 13 and 17 is sort of like a reverse Rumspringa, where like that's where you're supposed to be doing like your apprenticeship and, you know, like learning, you know.
You're serious.
Here, figure some stuff out, learn how to do things and be a useful person. Then when you have your second crowning or whatever we call it, then you can be an adult and
you know, now that we trust you can probably like feed yourself. You've learned the essential skills. We don't have to worry about you. You can go. You can
I
go
like
be,
that, yeah. though.
Be who you want to be now.
I like that it's also kind of counterintuitive in an interesting way that like kind of sort of appreciates a time of sober living for a while, right? Like before you truly can go taste all of the things that the world has to offer.
Snails.
Yeah.
You have to first know your own temperance, right? Your own discipline.
So you have your childhood and then you have your period of calm. And then you can do it to you. But like something like that, yeah. And that's just an accepted thing. I mean, of course, they're teenagers. They're going to do but what they're going to do. But I also think it's like a big thing is like it is very taboo for like it's one thing if a couple of kids in that time period fool around with each other while they're also like doing their apprenticeships. But it's considered extremely taboo for somebody who is an adult to do anything with somebody who is in that range.
They're sort of protected almost from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's funny too, because like the idea of a teenager and the idea of adolescence is so much wrapped up in this time when your brain is still forming and you're testing boundaries and you're rebelling. But it's in a society that is so generally permissive, like, what would they be rebelling against? What would be, once again, the taboo behavior, the pushing the boundaries for that age group in a culture that is so open and accepting? So, yeah, the reverse room springer makes sense from that standpoint, too.
And they might be like, you know what? I've learned something about myself that these people I've grown with are terrible, and I'm going to move to Fjallanir where people are calm,
or at least predictable.
Yeah,
not so much as humans can be
until they're not, right?
Until they're not.
I imagine because we've decided that they are connected by a gate that Griasa and Fjallanir get a lot of like. Overflow of each other's deviance.
That's probably true. Like, it's probably a self-selection type thing.
You're like, you know what? I'm done with this.
It's like, I'm actually not meant for these this life. I'm just going to hop over
but
there.
It would be interesting, though, to, like, see what the high water mark is, though, on either side. Like, you might think that you're more of, like, I was born to be in Griasta. And then you go there and you're like, oh, no.
Oh.
No, I am way more what I... you know, my culture than I thought that I was, which would be funny, I think.
I can see there being lots of, like, when we get to the technology point where teen movies are a thing, I can see that being a lot of them.
We have definitely gone over an hour.
Yeah.
So.
We have. But so we can either do this last one or we can skip it or do it some other time.
I feel like this last one's a little different from the rest, but, and I don't think I have any answers yet.
I don't have an answer. I don't. We've done exceedingly little on the concept of like what is the history
the
of
timeline
our world.
Of our world. Yeah, that might be. And, you know what? Let's put a pin in that and maybe make that an episode.
Agreed.
At some point in the future when we've got just the three of us again.
Because
maybe that's
our
season.
Really cool. Yeah, it'd be really cool that you create a timeline, right?
And that's a concept that deserves its own episode and its own discussion.
I think so.
Yeah.
Cool. So we'll just put a pin in that. You'll delete all of this so that the listeners don't know it's coming.
Or we can keep it in as a delightful tease of things to come.
Showing our ankles a little bit. We did it.
That was fun. I love when we get the chance to just like play in our worlds. And that was a lot of the fun of getting to write the anthology story too, was just getting to actually really spend some time in my world and in my culture. I didn't have to write it in Fjallanir, but I did. I sure did. It's a very Fjallanir story.
Well, mine takes place in Fjallanir as well, but
yeah,
it is about the sort of connection to the next place. So I need to still write a story about that.
I took full advantage of jumping all over the world and
you what sure that did. Would be
like. Nudie gating
it's a
raw dogging.
it's got it all. I mean, it's
Going Commando.
It's a great sampler.
It's going to be the title of the next anthology. Going Commando.
That'll be all the war stories for Heart World. No, like yours is very cinematic, Marshall. I can see it as like a short film. It would totally work as a, montage film.
It's a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun writing, and that's the important part.
That is the most important
part. And soon, dear listeners, you'll get to read all these.
Yes.
Hopefully in... Our goal is August, and we are on track for that goal. So,
yes,
we are. We've done the part that was going to take the most time. So, the writing and editing took some of us longer than others.
Yeah,
we are on track for August. So, hopefully, we will in August all be in Glasgow together, and have copies of it in hand.
And we'll do a cover reveal beforehand, which I think will be fun. Sure. So, yes.
Dear listeners, the cover is being designed by one Miss Natanya Barron, and we're very excited to see.
We're getting there.
That's going. We're getting there.
I've had one of those weeks, couple of weeks, where every single person that I do covers for has been like, and, oh, I've got this too, which is great. But also so much happening. But yes, hopefully by next week we'll have a draft again. And then soon after that, we'll have a reveal, which will be very exciting.
Yay.
Hi, you. Thanks for listening to this episode of World Building for Masochists and letting us help you overcomplicate your writing life. If you want to know more about your hosts and the fantastical books we write, links to all of that information is on our website at worldbuildingformasochists.podbeam.com. We also have an archive of all of our episodes and links to more information about the guests of every episode. We really hope you liked this episode. If you did, please do take a minute to tell a friend, shout about us on the internet, or leave a review on iTunes. If you've got questions or just want to tell us how cute we are, there's a number of ways to contact us. We're on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Threads as @WorldBuildCast, and our email is worldbuildcast@gmail.com. We also have a Discord chat room linked in the About the Show page of our website if you want to come chat with us and other fans of the podcast. We'd love for you to share the worlds you're making and help us all build until it hurts.